listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kalula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Wake Up Hollywood, this is your host and host, Nikki Kalula. I'm going to jump right into this interview. We have sci-fi author Calvin Fisher. Hello, Calvin. How are you, man?
I'm doing pretty well. How about yourself?
I'm good. I had a creative day, so those are always days that I'm excited about. So where are you living right now? Where are we doing this interview from?
I'm currently in Denver, Colorado, in a humble little suburb called Glendale. So weather's been pretty crazy here lately. But
is it snowing yet?
Not yet. It snowed a little bit down south, actually, in Colorado Springs, which is just an hour away. So I think, unfortunately, the snow's coming here for us quick.
Well, you know, they're not too lenient on Colorado. You know, the snow gods are like, let them have it always. So, you know, my hat's off to you. We also have a Glendale over here. I actually lived there for a little bit when I was super young. But let's go back to, did you always, were you born in Colorado? Did you always live in Colorado?
I was actually born and grew up in Minnesota. So awesome. Another cold place, a little colder than Colorado, so we're slowly inching our way warmer, so
that's good.
Who knows, maybe one day I'll be in the desert soon.
Did you go to high school there, or did you kind of leave there pretty early on?
I went to high school. I actually came out to Colorado for college. I went to the University of Denver, so that's where I went and sort of stuck around after that.
That's awesome. And you have a love of sci-fi. Tell me what the movie or the book was that kind of made you go down that rabbit hole.
You know, for me, I was, as a kid, huge into comic books, especially Spider-Man. I have practically a museum of Spider-Man comics. And from there, it sort of went from that realm of superheroes slowly, you know, into the realm of sci-fi. It's a pretty sort of natural sled down to there.
Well, Spider-Man is a classic, and it's one of my favorite characters. I used to watch, I mean, I'm much older than you, but I used to watch, there was like a 70s TV show of Spider-Man, and it's awesome, and I used to watch that when I was a kid all the time. So I have a fondness for Spider-Man myself.
That's an awesome one. Was it like the Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends one?
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember watching some of those reruns when I was a kid, too. That was a great show.
But, I mean, when the Tobey Maguire Spider-Man came out, that was the first reboot that was using all the tech and able to kind of show, like, that comic book side of the Spider-Man. Since you are a Spider-Man aficionado, which is your favorite Spider-Man series or movie?
As far as movies go, I'd have to say the Tobey Maguire ones. I'm definitely a bit biased because that's what I grew up with. And, you know, it's always hard to beat your first love. And as far as, like, the comic books go, there's one called Ultimate Spider-Man that sort of ran through that early 2000s, too. So, yeah, I guess just sort of the ones I grew up with, you know, but I still love them so much.
Well, you know, what's good about those movies is, like, The Tobey Maguire ones were very comic book driven, and now they're, you know, the Amazing Spider-Man series, and even the later ones are kind of becoming edgier. But what I liked about those is just, like, it gave Spider-Man new life for people like yourself to fall in love with Spider-Man all over again. So it's cool. I just love that whole concept of, you know, superheroes in general, and Stan Lee was just such a gangster with all of that stuff. Did you ever watch his show that was, it was called like Incredible, like real superheroes or something like that, Incredible People?
I did, yeah, where he just have a ton of people with these sort of crazy gifts or talents on. Yeah, I remember, I think I saw one where some lady could like take a whole bunch of electricity going through her body, and like another one who could, I think, like, punch through things really hard. I forget exactly what, but there's, like, some brick wall. But I guess I'll say, yeah, I remember watching that show.
So did you start kind of delving into reading sci-fi? Is that what made you want to start writing sci-fi?
Yeah, I have always been a reader. It's always been one of my big sort of passions and things I've enjoyed. I actually started reading a lot of thrillers, sort of like the Tom Clancy's and the Vince Flynn's, that sort of thing. I started actually reading sci-fi a little later, sort of later high school, just, you know, some of the classics, and just sort of went from there.
Did you read the Star Wars books ever?
I didn't. I heard those were pretty good adaptations of the movies, though.
Yeah, like some of them, I was kind of a dork about Star Wars. I still am. I have tons of Star Wars stuff and memorabilia, like R2-D2. Oh, you can't see him. He's plugged up. But yes, I've got all kinds of memorabilia everywhere. So the books were kind of my introduction to kind of taking a storyline and then letting a writer just run with it and take it into different dimensions and make up kind of a new storyline for these characters. Did you kind of fall in love with the, like, just having vast imagination and just like letting characters do their own thing? Did it start with movies? Did it start with like a certain book that made you kind of like want to like write or just keep reading these books?
I'd say it all goes back to those Spider-Man comic books. Sort of my first go about it was sort of similar in a not professional way to the Star Wars, where taking sort of the universe that exists and extending off of it and creating my own Spider-Man stories.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
What is your most valuable comic, by the way?
Oh, that's a good question. I guess monetary value, it'd be hard for me to say, but I guess the one I prize the most is the last issue of Ultimate Spider-Man, which I read. I think issue 160 was sort of the end of it all. That's definitely one of my most prized. I got it when it came out, and definitely has sort of a hardback and the nice wrapping around it still. So,
isn't it awesome? Like how I've actually had some comic book authors on our show, and it's just like it's such an interesting world that comic book, you know, medium is, because it's got so many levels of comic books, especially now. And you're right, they have sleeves, dust covers, the whole bit, hardback, paperback. You have collectors looking for like certain series or like mistakes on, you know, comics that make them more valuable. Did you kind of like go to those extremes with the comic book world? Or did you kind of just stay into just loving Spider-Man and just you started jumping into other forms of sci-fi?
I did, yeah. One of the things I always love to do is collect, they're called the graphic novels, where it's a collection of six or seven of them and sort of like a softback. And I love those the most just because as much as I love collecting them, I liked reading them even more. And that's just sort of a convenient way to read them without all the ads for bicycles and stuff like that you get in the sort of normal 20-issue ones. And then, yeah, when I went to books, it's still sort of similar thing. I've always been someone who likes having like a hard concrete book in my hand rather than doing like digital reading. Although I've been trying to do that a little
bit. I can't get into that. I can't get into digital books. It's very convenient. But there's something about, I mean, you can see it, like these are all CDs, and then all these shelves down here, they're all books, because I just love reading and I love like the feel of a hardcover book. I just love the print on it too. There's so many details of books. It's kind of crazy that people don't love them in the same way. But yeah, I'm old school. I love good bookstores are like a prize. They're like a jewel, you know. So I'm with you on all that. Now, you take on the daunting task of writing a book. How did it start? Did you start with outlines? Did you just start writing short stories? What made you want to become a sci-fi author?
So it was a lot of trial and error. I've written a lot of books before the one I'm publishing, Northfield. Just practicing, writing stories after stories until I get it right. Now, sort of after I've started honing my craft, I generally start with an outline. I find it just helps me keep everything organized, and especially writing a book's a pretty long process. So I sort of like knowing where I'm going to end up is somewhere that I like, and I'm not sort of just walking down a trail that leads to nowhere.
Right.
If that makes sense. So definitely an outline, then just sort of I start at the beginning and sort of work all the way through to the end. I know a few authors who jump around scenes, you know, if they're feeling an action scene one day, they'll write that, and then a talking scene the next day, and they'll kind of stitch everything together. But I just like going from start to end. It just helps keep everything straight in my head.
And do you do like a three act tier, or do you do four acts, or do you just kind of like think about chapters? Like, how do you know when one chapter ends and one begins?
So I'd say generally I follow a three act structure where there's the, I guess, building to the inciting incident, sort of then the midpoint to leading to the climax and resolution. As far as when chapter breaks come, that's a pretty sort of natural-ish thing, as far as I don't have a hard and fast rule, as far as usually it's good to leave a chapter on some sort of cliffhanger or something to intrigue them. One thing I learned from that I started doing when I initially started out was ending chapters when characters went to sleep, which is definitely not how you want to do it, because that's going to put your reader to sleep. So I still find that old habit, and I try to curb that as much as possible. But
that's an interesting way, like an approach. What was the reasoning? Because you found it like to be a physical ending on some level?
Yeah, it just felt like a sort of natural spot to end it. Usually if it was a day or some event had just happened where then they sleep, and then, you know, the next day or the next thing that happens follows. So characters going to sleep is a pretty sort of natural ending point. But it's definitely one where if you're going to use it sparingly, because you definitely got to keep readers on the hook to read the next chapter and the next.
Now, how do you edit a book once it's finished? Do you have an editor that kind of goes through, or do you go through it yourself and kind of like, you're like, okay, this needs to be edited down to a certain page count?
I start by editing myself. I'll usually do three or four, sometimes even five passes just myself before anyone looks at it, because it can be in pretty rough shape after, you know, spending months trying to scramble out a draft. I think Stephen King said it best, where it's like driving down a dark road without the headlights on. You know, you can plan as much as you want, but where it ends up, it just definitely needs a lot of cleanup. So I'll usually start with like bigger things because they're the hardest to change. So like making sure there aren't any giant plot holes or just things horribly wrong with the plot, and making sure the characters act logically and consistently. And I'll sort of move down to more fine-tuned things, like this sort of last draft I do before handing it off to other people is just making sure it's readable in the sense that sentences sort of flow well and that sort of thing. So then I give it off to beta readers to get some feedback, and then it goes to my my actual editor, who you know, makes sure the things I've missed or cleaning up sentences and that sort of thing.
What's that process like? Do they, you know, and I love that you mentioned Stephen King. He's one of my favorite authors, by the way. Such a great gifted writer. What is that process like between you and the editor? Do you kind of have the vision, obviously, and do you feel like your editor sometimes shares that vision, or sometimes they're like ready to truncate it so that it can fit a certain demographic or marketing tactic?
So for Northfield, I actually had two sets of editors. I first had a private editor that I've been working with, who it was just him and I, and that process was a lot of back and forth where I'd hand him a draft. He'd come back with suggestions, things to change. I'd make what changes I want, go back to him. And then my second round with my publisher's editors was definitely more, not so much the story or plot, just really trying to clean up sentences and make sure the grammar and everything goes absolutely as smoothly as possible for the reader.
That's got to be a little bit tricky, because you know, sometimes when you're creative, you just want to let things flow, and then you're having to edit that kind of like, you know, positive progress into something that's very technical. You know, it's just like you're thinking about the book as, is it grammatically correct? Is the punctuation correct? Are all those things? Do you find that when you're in that creative flow, you're not thinking about those things, I assume, right? You're thinking about story. You're like, trying to get, you know, the idea out? And do you find that that inspiration causes you to actually write faster and produce more? Like, what is your process? Do you have certain points you want to hit each day, or do you, you know, how do you go about it?
I usually go for a page amount I try to hit. So generally a couple pages a day, depending on if it's, you know, a weekday or weekend. And yeah, as far as that goes, I tend to be a pretty slow writer myself, just very methodical and just wanting to get everything right the first time. So because of that, I sometimes wish I'd write a little faster than I do, because I find myself agonizing over little details or how to describe something just right. So it would be nice sometimes, you know, to just kind of really go with that creative flow. But I find myself definitely being more of the slow and steady turtle.
Well, sometimes that's good. I love that you're that honest and candid about it. You know, I've known a lot of writers, in my time, and a lot of them have this discipline where they wake up at a certain time in the morning and they just want to get writing before the day even starts. Do you find like there's a certain time of day that inspires you to write more, or do you find that it's kind of sporadic and whenever inspiration hits, that's when you write?
So my old process used to be right when I was done with my day job or whatever I had going on. Right when I got home, the first thing I'd do is write out my pages.
Wow.
I ended up actually changing my schedule around because life just sort of really fills up. And I realized I needed to do what you were saying, where the first thing I did in the morning had to be to write, because who knows what the rest of the day will bring, but I know if I wake up at a certain time, I'm guaranteed those couple hours in the morning to myself to write. And since I started doing that, I've noticed it's been a lot more consistent of a process.
Yeah, I'm a songwriter, so sometimes I find myself, I'll wake up at like 4 a.m. and start writing between 4 and 6 or practice. And I find that, those like early morning hours where the whole world is asleep, where they're kind of like moonlighting hours, are extremely creative. But it's also the worst to figure out, oh my God, it's 4 a.m. Now's my time to be creative, when you just want to sleep, dude. So do you find yourself as an artist like forcing yourself to like get the work done and to maybe not be as social? Because like writing is not a very social activity, as you know. You're with your thoughts and you're isolated and you're concentrating. So do you find that it makes you want to do less with people so that you can focus on it? Or do you sleep less as a result because you're so focused on it? Or do you kind of have this balance where you're able to use life, for inspiration, and then also, you know, strategize what you're going to create?
I'd say it's sort of the first thing you described, where it can be hard sometimes to fit other things in or get that social time, just because sometimes you're in such the mindset of you need to be, you know, alone to really focus on this body of work you're creating. And like you said, it's just a difficult balance to find, but I think forcing yourself to wake up in the morning, no matter how much you may hate it when you first have to crack open your crusty eyes at whatever time and just get going on it, I found that to just sort of be the best for as far as life balance and consistency.
Well, you know, and it's funny too, because there's so many great writers that come out of cold parts of the country or the world. So, you know, Stephen King would love to be in the snow and write, because it forced you to not do anything else except focus on your talent. So like you living in Colorado, when you have these blizzards, are you like, I'm going to spend that time writing and being productive? Or does it make you not want to work because you're so overwhelmed by the weather?
That is, you know, that's so insightful. I haven't actually thought of that, but that's so true. As far as it's a lot harder in the summer to write. As far as once it gets to the winter months, the probably November through March is definitely when I'd say I'm the most productive as far as just raw workflow getting through. And I think it is because when you're waking up and it's really cold outside, and just snow is just coating everything, it's, you know, easy to crack open your laptop and get working. While if the sun's shining, you know, it's a nice 80 degree day where it might be good to take a walk. It definitely has a good way of focusing you in.
And, you know, when you're getting feedback from friends, you're handing your book off to friends and family. Like, it's such a daunting task to read somebody's work because, you know, books are usually 200 or 300 pages. It's like an involved thing. And so, you know, you're not going to hear back from that person for at least 2 weeks to maybe 3 months. What is your expectation when you hand somebody your book and you're like, hey, let me know what you think? What is your expectation is the turnaround?
So what I usually do is try to hand it off to like 8 people and hope that, you know, 2 or 3 of them pull through just because it's, you know, I always think of it and I can get judgy wudgy on my side, but then I think about if it was me on that end, I just know for a lot of people, life gets in the way and everyone means well, but it can be really hard for people to set aside the time. As far as, like you said, it's really involved for a book because that takes hours and hours of people's time, especially if they have to write comments and things like that. It's sort of like doing a book report, which everyone remembers how much they hate book reports from school. But I'd be sort of curious, as far as music goes, do you ever have people in your family or people you know listen to the music you create and judge it? Or I've always been curious.
Everybody judges it. I think, you know, that's why you make art. It's like, you know, when you make art, you know, it's going to it's going to have a response. And I think that's like, for me, it's like the worst thing that could happen is if you make something and people are numb to it. It's like, if they have an opinion, you know, there's impact already. So I always look at that as always forward progress. But, you know, I have the same thing when I do an album. It's like it's only 45 minutes to an hour of music. But even just having somebody go through an album and listen to the whole thing and get back to you with feedback, that's a lot of time for somebody to invest into doing it. So it's like, luckily, you know, I've got fans and people that have seen, you know, how it all has unfolded over the years. And been very supportive and have fans around the world now. But it definitely still, especially now, because the attention span, as you know, everybody's attention span is so little. So it's like even showing somebody a song, I find that now people will interrupt the song to make a comment when I'm just like, yo, just listen. Give me 3 to 4 minutes. Listen to the whole thing. So I ask that question selfishly as a musician because I'm like, you have to know that you're not going to get that response back because I already know that from music, from a 3-minute song, I'm not going to get that response back. So, you know, you must be very patient with getting those responses because you have to be because you know, all right, this person may not finish the book, may get through a couple chapters, may finish it 3 months later, maybe a year from now when you've already released the book. So, but you know what? It's your vision that you have to always stand by, and it's what you come up with. Let's get more into the book. Tell me about like how you came up with the title and how you came up with the characters and what kind of started. You know, you said you made an outline, but like what was the catalyst to like make you feel like, okay, I need to write a book about this?
So as we were saying, I've always just been inspired by sci-fi and especially post-apocalyptic works. They've always intrigued me because I think they explore a certain side of humanity and really delve into sort of what the darkest things we're all capable of and looking at people coming through the other side, which I find very inspiring. But the story with my book, Northfield, or I guess the official title now is The Northfield Saga, and then book one is The Apocalypse Bounty. It started actually as a thriller in the vein of the Tom Clancy's and the Vince Flynn's I was describing, but just sort of through the trial and error, I just sort of had a light bulb moment, which I'm sure you know as a musician, where I just realized that it all would come together if there was a post-apocalyptic novel. And from there, just all of the pieces came in. And as far as the title specifically, the Northfield Saga refers to, it's a saga, so there's going to be 4 books in total. Mark Northfield is the main character, and he's really what everything's about, more than the world and the sort of general story going on. It's really an exploration of just how he endures and goes through all of this. And the Apocalypse Bounty is the name of the first book, and that's sort of the challenge he's facing.
So do you find you put yourself in the main character's shoes? Do you find it like you're objective and watching this whole world unfold? Or do you feel like there's maybe a minor character that you feel more attached to, that you're living through this experience and kind of on the journey?
I'd say I attach the most definitely to the main character, Mark Northfield. He definitely does have certain parts of my personality and values in it. I wouldn't call him quite a self-insert, though, because there's a whole bunch of different influences that go into him. One of the biggest is a few of the Spider-Man runs I was talking about earlier, just sort of how they explored Peter Parker's character was another thing that really made me want to write a book like this. That's sort of... Sorry, what was that?
No, go ahead.
Oh, that's okay. Actually, I think I lost my train of thought, so you go.
Well, I was going to say, like, most characters have a duality in superhero books. Kind of explain if you have that kind of duality with Mark Northfield.
Yeah, so I'd say his duality is this conflict he had of whether to stand by his principles and what he believes. But that also means at the same time, in this dark post-apocalyptic world, that standing by his choices also might mean there's a lot of collateral damage. And he doesn't know if the blood on his hands is worth standing by the principles and the promises he's made. So there's this really big tension of whether, I guess, the practicality of the world is more important than who he is as a person, whether he should compromise on that.
Well, it's also interesting that you take a post-apocalyptic world as your subject matter. And I have to ask, is it because you see how the world is currently working that you know we are going to screw things up?
You know, it's so funny because I started writing the book in 2017 and had most of the big things into place. And in the first chapter of the book, the main character is complaining how much he doesn't want to have a mask on his face, which is just, which then when it comes out in 2020, I'm like, great, people are going to think I just completely am jumping on, the COVID bandwagon. But I do think, with anything, it takes some inspiration from current events or things, but it's not really intended to be an actual big projection into what might happen in the future. But just sort of exploring people becoming colder and more distant just due to the world conditions.
Well, it's, it's funny because like most of these stories people would say are very dark, but I also see that a lot of these, characters are kind of like the light in a dark world. And you must have like this, affinity to just, the conflict of those two worlds, light and dark kind of intertwining. Tell me a little bit about that and how it related to each character.
Absolutely. So the main character, Mark Northfield, this is something he struggles with a lot. One thing he values is the idea of the afterlife and what comes after. And he holds a lot of hope in what comes there. And just sort of the overall good that still lies in the heart of the world, although he has a profound struggle at seeing it a lot of the time. And then as far as the side characters go, another big one, her name is Elena. I won't exactly spoil under which circumstances she's met, but she definitely holds the most hope. She's the most youthful character of the group. And she definitely wants to get back to a world where everyone is doing what they can to help each other rather than always just being focused on what they can get the next day. So I'd say she definitely holds the most idealism as far as what the future might bring.
Hmm. And did you use Joseph Campbell is the hero's journey is a huge kind of writer's Bible. Did you use any kind of those concept of the hero's journey and attach it to any of your characters or your main character's trajectory in the story?
I wouldn't say explicitly. I took, just a lot of intuition and things I've seen in other stories as far as, Mark's journey, as far as it's more what his internal journey is and his dilemma as he's going through this. and just sort of how he has to adapt to the changing circumstances. So I'd say through that, there's a definite intention in each character having some sort of growth or change by the story as it goes on.
And did you find that it was that you were getting emotionally attached to characters? I know there were some characters you had to kill off at some point. Did you find yourself emotionally attached to any character that you found it difficult to either have their trajectory of their story or their character arc end? Or did you find that it wasn't a problem and you were able to just wipe your hands clean of it because they're just imaginary characters in your mind?
Well, I definitely say I get attached to them. What's funny is when writing the book, there's one character who I didn't think a whole lot of, but as I was writing, I just realized how easy it was to write this character. And once I was done, I looked back and I sort of realized, like, I think this guy's going to be the fan favorite and that everyone's going to like the most. I don't want to quite say who that is just because I'm kind of curious when the book comes out if my theory will pan out as far as who it is. But I'd say it was a lot that where I didn't initially have a ton of attachment to a lot of the characters. But as I was writing and really fleshing out their just who they were through the process of writing, I think all of them sort of have that certain spark that I definitely did attach to.
Now, when it came to, you know, choosing your cover, did you have like an illustrator or somebody that you loved their work, or did you have an idea of like how the characters looked in your mind, and were you able to complete that vision with somebody, or did you kind of go through trial and error to try and figure out what your characters in your mind looked like versus the illustrators?
So my publisher was actually the one who selected the cover, and it was... You know, honestly, the more I look at it, the more it's growing on me. I think the way the title looks on it, as well as the image, definitely intrigue and sort of pull your eyes off the shelf. So it wasn't one I chose just because that's what my publisher handled, but I ended up really enjoying what they selected.
So you went with the experts. You were like, you guys do this for a living. Why don't you choose?
Exactly. Yeah, I had a whole bunch of fantasies of what I wanted my cover to look like, you know. And then when I saw it, I was like, that's probably the cover that, you know, is going to sell books and probably what it should be rather than whatever craziness I'd try to put on there.
Did you get to choose like the font or anything like that? Any detail like that?
Not really. I got to choose the title, which I was happy about, as well as just, publishing name and that sort of thing. So they're sort of experts really handled the cover art and stuff, which I suppose is good. Yeah, leaving it to the experts, I think, was the right idea in the end.
Now, you're a pretty young cat. Like, my generation loves books, and the generation before me loves books even more. My dad and my brother are, like, hardcore readers. They love books. You're now in an age where your peers don't necessarily love books. They are wanting everything to be on their phone, able to, you know, just go through things digitally. Now you've got this book coming out. Tell me how you convince your peers or people your age to get into a hardcover book, because let's be honest, that's where the magic is like owning the book, holding the book, reading the book, and being able to go through the book and thumb through it whenever you want. You know, there's a magic to that. So tell me, you growing up in this digital age, how do you get your peers or people excited about a hardcover book?
So I take a little bit of hope, at least, that I love video games and a lot of the sort of modern technology stuff. And yet I still find the time to love reading. And actually, a lot of my friends who I didn't meet them through the author world, they're just people I grew up with. A surprising amount of them do read. So I don't have any stats, but I'm hoping more people in my age range read than a lot of people fear. But I think it all comes down to telling a good story. One of the examples I always use is like anime. It's not really my thing. I've never watched it. It's just not my cup of tea. I don't have anything against it, but someone enticed me by watching one because it apparently had a really good story, and I sat down and watched it and got completely absorbed. And it was this medium that I never really thought I would watch or be interested in, but this one story brought me in. And I think it's the same way as books. I think if it's a really good book, people will read it, even if they're not really accustomed to reading. And I guess that's always been my thought, which might be a little naive, but when I sort of see how it applied to me with something I wasn't particularly interested in, but because the story drew it out, that's sort of where I stand on that.
Well, you know, I say that because music, I've seen it change so many forms, and now it's reduced to an MP3 on a phone, and it's played, like, so many people show me music on a phone, and I'm like, oh my God, I've got speakers behind me, I've got speakers in front of me, I've got good headphones within a grasp of me, you know, like, that's just the way I like to consume music and my art form, and I just don't understand people that don't. But I also commend artists that still make art despite how people kind of, you know, ingest it or kind of lack some sort of respect for the art form to, like, have the experience as good as it can get, you know? So I hope you always continue to write books. Do you have more plans to write another saga or a continuation of this story? Do you have an outline made currently for a future book, or are you completely jumping ship and writing something completely foreign and different?
So I'm planning on writing the Northfield saga for 4 books. They're all pretty well planned out. The next one actually is coming out next June. So pretty soon, 6 months after the first one. So, we've got that to look forward to. As far as what's after all 4 books are out, I have another big plan for a fantasy trilogy that I'm hoping to write. I might do a couple of different one-shot sci-fi novels between those. But I guess all that's to say, you know, some of that's up in the air, but I'm definitely planning on writing a lot of books for the foreseeable future.
And what do you think was, like, one of the biggest obstacles in you writing this book?
That's a great question. I think probably just as far as timing, as far as exactly when the book was done, especially just because it did go through so many changes as far as starting in an entirely different genre, just really hammering home exactly what the world was like and just reaching that state where it was sort of the debut book I wanted to come out with. Because before this, I've written about 8 other novels, which I didn't really think those were ready for prime time. So to take this one to that level where I would be happy with was, I think, the hardest thing. Because, as I'm sure you know, as a musician, you're your own greatest critic. So,
well, and it's also like, yeah, you can indulge yourself into the torture of this, the pursuit of perfection, which does not exist and does not affect sales one bit. So my question is, how did you know when it was finished? Like, how did you know, okay, I'm objective enough, I put enough distance between me and the baby, and now I know it's finished?
So I'd say a couple things. The first was once I finally sort of stamped out the big world-ending plot holes where it's like, oh man, how didn't I think of this? Or just getting a lot of those things out of the way. I think also when I'd read passages or things and actually like them, which again goes to, I'm just a really harsh critic on myself. So I know once I'm happy with someone, with something, the odds are most other people reading it will find it satisfactory. And yeah, I just say it comes down to the characters are the biggest part of the story. So once I felt like all of the characters or people the audience would root for and want to see succeed was sort of the point when I put my foot down and had to stop that, like you're saying, obsessive want of reaching perfection and making every sentence sound like it came out of a Walt Whitman poem or whatever, whatever you have.
Ebb and flow, man. Ebb and flow. You have to find that balance. Now I'm going to put you on the spot. Do you have your book near you?
I actually don't. The book actually just printed, so I actually haven't gotten my own copy yet from shipping.
I was
So,
gonna say, do you think you can read us like a little passage or something from the book?
oh man, I
Don't worry about
I should have been prepared.
No, no,
Oh
that's
man, I
okay.
should have
Look, you don't even have a
prepared.
printed copy yet. How can you be prepared? Don't worry about it. That just adds to the excitement of people having to read it. We'll have to bring you back. That's just a reason for you to come back. No, I only say that because, advertising for books and marketing this stuff, it's so intriguing, like how, you can't judge a book by its cover, even though your publisher chose the right cover. But what it comes down to is how you can pull in the audience with words. Like, you must love words like I love words. I find words to be probably the most important integral part of life because it literally bridges the gap between two souls, So when you're writing these words and when you're coming up with, prose or just even conflict or character arcs or, you're putting them into sketches of a storyline. When it comes together, there's got to be points where you're like, man, there's certain pages that you're like, yes. And I always find that it's good when somebody can like read a page or something and get an essence of what the writer's style is like. But did you find when you were writing this that there were certain pages that you were really excited or proud or pumped for people to read? Did you find certain scenarios or things that you wrote that you were like, I can't wait till people get to this part of the book?
Absolutely. I think one of the more unique things that my book does is that the main character, Northfield, he has been living in this post-apocalyptic world essentially by himself for a decade. When you think about that's an incredibly long time for someone to be alone, you know? So that with sort of the spirituality he has a lot of conversations with both his past wife and God in his head. And they're really humorous and pretty irreverent, and I think they sort of really speak to the human condition. And I think they've, for all my readers, they've been some of their favorite parts of the book. So I think at least for me, that's one of the special sauce things about this that you're not going to see really in a lot of other sci-fi books. So I'm excited for readers to read those parts specifically and just sort of hear these, I guess, funny and to be completely frank, weird monologues he has about just the predicaments he's going through and just the sort of off-color jokes he makes that I guess really speak to the sort of deeper humanity and struggles he's enduring.
And do you find that when you're writing this, like your hopes, the long game is, oh, it'd be pretty cool to see this on a screen and see a movie made from this movie? Or do you feel like you're a purist and the book is always better than the movie? And you're like, no, I never want any of that because I've written this piece of work and this is an art for me. And that is what I want people to, that's how I want people to savor the experience. Like, how do you want people to enjoy this story?
You know, I feel like the good author thing to say would be that I'm a complete purist. But I'm a huge movie junkie too, so I get such a huge kick out of it being on a screen. I think too, a lot of books are just really hard to put on the screen. Like, for instance, I just finished reading Dune, and it's an amazing book. But while reading, I was like, I don't know how on earth they would manage to make a movie that's any good out of this. Like, it would just be such a difficult movie to make. But I think sort of the length and the pacing of my book, I think it would lend itself pretty well to a movie if one was ever made. I think some things, like I was saying, were those inner monologues. That would be pretty weird to try to translate into a movie. I don't know exactly how a filmmaker would do that. So I think there's certain parts of the book that you really would miss out on with a movie, but I'm in the camp if it brings more people to enjoy the book or even just sort of enjoy the broader story I've created, the more the merrier. So I'd love that someday if it were to happen.
And like when you give birth to these characters, you're thinking about characteristic traits, physical things. Like, let's talk about the main character, Northfield. When you came up with this character, was was there a moment where you kind of completely visualized him, or you knew exactly what you wanted people to feel when you were describing the things he was going for? He sounds like this, like, this tormented loner that's just like, my whole world has collapsed literally and figuratively. Now what do I do to pick up the pieces? Like, how did you paint this character, and what made it come together for you?
So for me, he was actually a lot different to how I normally do characters, because I usually start with sort of where they're at in the story and how they sort of play into the larger narrative, and from there sort of figure out their characteristics. And the hard thing is, you definitely want to avoid that feeling where a character is just like a stat on a Yu-Gi-Oh card or something like that, where it's like they're a happy-go-lucky person or that sort of thing. So, but for him, it really was like I just heard his voice in my head and just pictured what I guess he looked like, and just the expressions and things he had in these situations. It's sort of hard to explain, but it's almost like I felt an essence of him, and that was sort of enough to go off of. It was sort of a unique experience that I haven't had with a lot of characters, which I think is sort of why he came around particularly well. And it is the same for a few other characters in the novel, where it just sort of came together in a way. I usually do a lot of planning, but those ones sort of came to me in a pretty, I guess, natural way. And it was more going from that sort of natural understanding I already had to just putting some things on a notebook to kind of remind myself as I was going along.
Well, and it sounds like your character has layers, or your characters have layers. So it's just like, did you find that you wanted the impression to be one way of how people were interpreting your characters, only to be deceived, or, you know, have a turnaround with these character arcs that led them to a completely different feeling?
I'd say with him, it is a lot the idea of the onion, where you're just peeling back layers as you go. And the more you get into the book, the more, I guess, like you said, multifaceted it is, where you can sort of interpret things going on with him in a variety of ways, even though you do have this really close-up perspective of what he's going through. And it's sort of the same with the other characters, where I do really try to avoid just making them some cardboard cutout, just because I think it can be sort of boring and played out. And I think readers do have an, I guess, intuitive sense of when characters are, I guess, alive in a sense, rather if they're more just a static cardboard cutout. It's sort of, they know it when they see it, even if they can't describe it articulately. So that's definitely always what I go for. Of course, you know, some characters who's only in their three pages, you're not going to make the next Walter White or something like that.
Right.
So that's just definitely my approach, where I want there to be layers for them. And even if you don't get the whole glimpse of everything this character is, you get this sense that there's always something deeper if you got to know them a little better.
I love that. I love when characters do have that, because I find that to be a lot like people. It's like people are layered, you know? So it's like there are certain places you'll feel, oh, this person is one way, and then they're not, you know? So I love that. Who are some of your biggest influences as far as sci-fi writers, or just writers in general? We mentioned Stephen King, and I love you mentioned him, because I literally was thinking about him as you said, oh, the great Stephen King says. I'm like, oh, yes, perfect.
Yeah, I haven't read a ton of Stephen King, but I absolutely love The Stand. I thought that was an incredible novel, as well as his Gunslinger. And I've read a couple of his short stories, which I really liked. The biggest, I'd say, are a fantasy author named Brent Weeks. I think he does an incredible job of having plots that are have a lot of complexity, but are also very easy to understand. While also all of his characters have sort of what I was saying I aspire to, where they all have these multi-layers and the sense that there's a lot more under the surface going on with them. I'd say Cormac McCarthy is pretty big too. I just think the way he writes is just pure art. It goes back to the, you know, poeticness and just pretty much every line he writes. It's just awesome. And I think The Road is probably my favorite post-apocalyptic novel. I think that one's just incredible. And then there's a few comic book authors. There's one, J. Michael Stranowski. I always can't remember his last name.
I don't know him
at all. 15 letters long. But he wrote a pretty big chunk of The Amazing Spider-Man. He did a pretty big run on it. He also wrote the TV show Babylon 5, I think.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And he's done a couple of things. He's sort of been in a lot of those different sci-fi spaces, but I think if readers read his Spider-Man arc and then read my novel, they'd probably see a lot of the parallels between what's going on between them. I'd say that's probably the biggest direct inspiration.
What I love too is like when you can feel a person's influences in their writing, like the people they love, because that's what draws me to musicians. It's like when I know somebody's influenced by Eric Clapton or Stevie Ray Vaughan or a blues guy or even a reggae guy like Bob Marley, I'm drawn to their music right away because I'm like, oh, yes, this totally makes sense. I totally get this. So I love that you're very versed in who your influences are and how that influences your writing. I'm going to ask you the million-dollar question now, all right? If you were to sum up your book in one word, what would that be?
One word. That's tough. One word. I'd say solace.
That's a good one. Post-apocalyptic world, it's definitely going to have some solace. You know, it's got to. That's the hope that we need, man. I love that. Good word. And Calvin, you've been a wonderful guest. Your book comes out November 2nd, correct?
Yep, November 2nd, and it'll be available on Amazon or on my website. So if you look up Calvin B. Fisher or Northfield, you'll find it.
CalvinBFisher.com, correct?
CalvinFisherMedia.com.
CalvinFisherMedia.com. And what about social media? Where can people find you?
So I have a Facebook group. A Facebook page, also Calvin Fisher Media, as well as a Twitter that I regularly post updates and just tweets on, also CalvinFisherMedia.com. So if you search my name, those guys should hopefully come up and you'll be able to find my work and the social media.
Apocalypse Bounty, November 2nd, right?
Yep, November 2nd, Apocalypse Bounty.
November 2nd, all major bookstores, all major Amazon, Kindle. You get your hardcovers. Check it out. Check out Calvin Fisher. Calvin, thank you for being a wonderful guest. We're going to have you back for your saga books that you're going to keep writing. So we welcome you back. We want to know more about your story and your books that you're writing. On behalf of Sam, myself, and Calvin, we'll see you guys here next week. Calvin, we wish you the best of luck in your book, man.
Thanks so much for having me on the show. This has been a blast. We'll have to do it again for sure.
We'll do it again for sure, man. You've been a wonderful guest, and you're a great cat. And high 10, man. I'm giving you the high 10.
Yeah, high 10. Let's do it.
Well, you take care of yourself, and I'm looking forward to catching the book, man. So November 2nd, Apocalypse Bounty. Get your copy. Calvin, we wish you the best of luck, and thanks for being on Wake Up Hollywood.
Thanks so much for the opportunity. You take care, too.
All right. Be good, guys. Thanks, man. We'll talk soon. Woohoo!
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Corulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.